This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, the Senate confirms Scott Pruitt as EPA administrator, despite a court order for the release of his emails with fossil fuel executives. Immigration police arrest hundreds nationwide, and operations advocates say signal a clear shift in enforcement priorities. And suicide is the number two cause of death among 15 to 24-year-olds. We look at some of the reasons why. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Nearly 4 weeks into the Donald Trump presidency, before his freshman cabinet is even fully confirmed, the administration suffered its first high-level casualty this week. Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn, tendered his resignation Monday night after information about conversations he had in December with a Russian envoy became public. The telephone call, which was intercepted by U.S. intelligence, took place in December, after Trump's Electoral College victory, but before his inauguration. The Department of Justice, under since-fired acting director Sally Yates, informed the White House last month that Flynn provided inaccurate information about the contents of the calls when questioned by the FBI. But rather than taking issue with evidence that one of his senior staff discussed easing U.S. sanctions against Russia with that country's ambassador, in a press conference Thursday, Trump defended Flynn.
Flynn is a fine person, and I asked for his resignation. He respectfully gave it. He is a man who, there was a certain amount of information given to Vice President Pence, who's with us today, and I was not happy with the way that information was given. He didn't have to do that because what he did wasn't wrong. What he did in terms of the information he saw, what was wrong was the way that other people, including yourselves in this room, were given that information. Because that was classified information, it was given illegally. That's the real problem.
As a member of the president's staff, the National Security Advisor does not require Senate confirmation. Flynn was officially named to the post on Inauguration Day. But other senior officials are still wending their way through congressional approval. As we wrap up production, the Senate is voting on multiple cabinet positions. First up was Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. The Senate confirmed him along a party-line vote to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. Republicans on the Environment and Public Works Committee suspended quorum rules to advance his nomination to the Senate floor this week. The push came as a judge in Oklahoma scheduled an emergency hearing on a long-standing records request for emails and other correspondence between Pruitt and fossil fuel company executives. Thursday afternoon, the court ordered the release of thousands of emails. Senate Democrats held the floor through the night in a failed effort to delay the vote in order to give them time to review the documents. FSRN's Roe Packard has more.
Clearly, this is an epic ram job.
Flanked by a handful of colleagues, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island told reporters that the Senate Republican leadership refused to delay the vote on the confirmation of Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA. They wanted to wait until after an Oklahoma judge ruled on an open records lawsuit over emails between the nominee and fossil fuel industry executives.
And the idea that we are now going to hand the keys to our Environmental Protection Agency to a person so compromised, who has absolutely established himself as the tool and the minion of the fossil fuel industry, is a really disgraceful day for the United States of America.
The open records request for Pruitt's emails with fossil fuel industry leaders date back more than 2 years, when the Wisconsin-based Center for Media and Democracy first began tracking Pruitt and his multiple lawsuits against the agency he's since been tapped to lead. When the Center for Media and Democracy only received a partial response to their records request, they filed a lawsuit in an effort to force disclosure ahead of the pending confirmation vote. Nick Cerkey is the center's director of research.
We're seeking release of emails and other documents from 9 public records requests that we filed, but the one that has been getting the most attention is one that we filed 25 months ago, which was seeking email communications between Scott Pruitt and a number of coal, oil, and gas companies, including Devon Energy, Peabody Energy, and Koch Industries. And we received just a small number of emails in response. It's very clear to us that many emails, in fact, thousands of emails, have been held back.
Senate Democrats are holding the floor, running down a 30-hour procedural clock ahead of the confirmation vote. Delaware Senator Tom Carper says he personally asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to delay the vote by 10 days in order to give time to review the documents, but was told no.
In my gut, I feel that these emails, the nature of these emails and the entities with whom they were sent and received, will help us understand the truth. In order of the truth, we won't make a mistake. But that opportunity is going to be denied to us. And sometime a week from now, maybe days from now, we'll have some idea what the truth is. And my fear is that a number of members, especially on the other side, would have been put in a very bad position and asked to vote for a nominee that they otherwise may not have supported had they known the truth.
Multiple media outlets report EPA staff have been told President Trump plans to sign executive orders affecting the agency when Pruitt is sworn in. For FSRN, I'm Ro Packard.
Contentious confirmation hearings extended beyond cabinet posts this week when the Senate Foreign Relations Committee considered the first country-level ambassadorship the incoming administration has tried to fill. Trump's pick for envoy to Israel is Daniel Friedman, a bankruptcy lawyer known for his hardline right-wing rhetoric, a longtime financial supporter of Israeli settlement activity, vocal opponent of the Iran nuclear deal, and skeptic of the viability of a two-state solution. Almost as soon as Friedman began his opening remarks, protesters interrupted the proceedings. They continued to do so periodically throughout his testimony.
Now, American Jews against the occupation. David Friedman, you promote racism, fund illegal settlements.
Repeatedly questioned about his stated position on the U.S. long-standing support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the nominee said that his personal feelings would not affect his ability to represent the formal position of the United States.
I have expressed my skepticism about the two-state solution solely on the basis of what I've perceived as an unwillingness on the part of the Palestinians to renounce terror and accept Israel as a Jewish state. I think that, in my view, is a foundational problem.
Yet his testimony directly contradicts his record, in which he has called the widely accepted framework for peace, quote, an illusory solution in search of a non-existent problem. A shifting level of U.S. commitment to a two-state solution was also evident during a joint press conference at the White House Wednesday. Following a state visit, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the president took questions from the media, during which Trump waffled on the concept.
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one.
Trump's statements sparked a quick response. While in Cairo on a six-country diplomatic trip through the region, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said there is no other viable option.
There is no plan B to the situation between Palestinians and Israelis, but a two-state solution, and that everything must be done to preserve that possibility.
During the confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey asked the nominee for the Israeli ambassadorship if not a two-state outcome, what he would propose as an alternative solution to the conflict.
I sitting here today, I don't have a better option.
Five former U.S. ambassadors to Israel, who served under both Republican and Democratic presidents, sent a letter to the Senate urging lawmakers to find Friedman unqualified for the post.
FSRN is independent media supported by listeners like you. For more information about how to keep us on the air and online, please visit our website at fsrn.org.
The full scope of the recent nationwide immigration actions remains unclear. Earlier this week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced they had detained more than 680 people, but officials have not updated that number since Tuesday. Meanwhile, reports from around the country indicate agents continue to make arrests in the context of what ICE calls routine enforcement actions. But immigrant rights advocates say the actions are a significant departure from what was common under the enforcement priorities of the Obama administration. Marielena Incapia, executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, says the arrests following Trump's executive order on interior immigration enforcement do not reflect what were previously considered humanitarian exceptions.
All of those guidances apparently have been tossed out the window. This is a new day. This is the deportation force that he has been threatening with since his campaign. That's the big difference.
Agents arrested at least two young men with authorization under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, one in Seattle and another in San Antonio. They also arrested a woman in El Paso while she was at the courthouse seeking a restraining order in a domestic abuse case. And in Denver, a Mexican-born mother has taken sanctuary in a church instead of risking deportation at a scheduled check-in. Shannon Young has more.
Official information about the immigration enforcement actions has been sparse and slow-moving, but one thing is clear. The Obama-era guidelines on high- and low-priority removals are no longer in place. In a written statement issued Tuesday, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly said ICE officers had arrested more than 680 people in the Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, San Antonio, and New York City areas of responsibility. That list does not include cities where immigration arrests also occurred, like Seattle, where 23-year-old DACA recipient Daniel Ramirez Medina was taken into custody. Ramirez is the first known case of a person with legal status targeted in the new wave of immigration sweeps.
Daniel has been in detention now for a couple of days, unfairly and unjustly.
Paul Quiñones, a Seattle-based DACA recipient himself, says that while in custody, Ramirez has been pressured to sign a confession of gang affiliation.
And we have seen ICE lying about him and trying to defame him and paint him as a criminal, which is nothing more than them carrying out Trump's executive orders on interior enforcement and seeking to further criminalize our communities and expand the definition of who is a criminal.
DHS, of which ICE is a part, says that approximately 75% of those arrested in the enforcement actions have histories of criminal convictions.
Instead of focusing on the removal of hardcore criminals, a quarter of the people detained in the ICE raids are innocent people, including the arrest of a dreamer in Seattle.
Los Angeles Congresswoman Linda Sanchez says the acting director of ICE canceled a scheduled meeting with members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. The lawmakers specifically wanted to discuss the nationwide actions launched last week.
We've heard that some parents aren't sending their kids to school because they're afraid to. People are not answering the door. They're not leaving their homes to go to work because of the fear that these raids have incited.
ICE maintains the actions are not raids, but that, quote, during targeted enforcement operations, ICE officers frequently encounter additional suspects who may be in the United States in violation of federal immigration laws. Those persons will be evaluated on a case-by-case basis and, when appropriate, arrested by ICE, unquote. Daniel Ramirez Medina, the dreamer arrested in Seattle, appears to have been what attorneys call a collateral arrest, meaning that agents decided to take him in while searching for someone else, in this case, Ramirez's father. But the fact that he had status under DACA has sent a chill through the large community of immigrant youth with the same type of papers. Juan Escalante is a Florida-based DACA recipient and digital campaigns manager with the advocacy organization America's Voice.
You know, the government did promise, you know, for people who enrolled in this program that their personal information would not be used as a device for targeting them for immigration enforcement, A, and B, that they would, you know, be protected under this program just as long as they met the requirements established by such and they passed a background check.
DACA benefits young immigrants brought to the U.S. as minors without authorization, which means, in most cases, their parents are undocumented. Many Dreamers now worry that the information they provided as part of the vetting process can now be used against their families. Escalante explains some of the requirements.
You have to essentially provide proof that you have resided in the country for at least 5 years with no interruptions, meaning that you should not have left the country at any period of time. There is an age requirement, biometrics requirement, an application fee of $455, a background check to which you have to submit very detailed information as to where who you are, any sort of affiliations that you may have, if any at all, and you provide a history of your residence, meaning that where you have lived throughout your time here in the United States, and the level of detail that is demanded in these applications is extremely explicit, all of which, was turned over, again, in goodwill by immigrant youth to the government for verification and approval in order to confer them this deferred action status.
And it's not just DACA recipients who are now suddenly questioning if their status makes them a target of the immigration authorities with whom they have contact. The recent deportation of Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes sent a message that longtime undocumented residents with U.S.-born children could no longer take solace in being considered a low priority for removal. Garcia de Reyes was arrested during a routine check-in with immigration authorities and summarily deported to Mexico hours later. Juntos. Jeanette Vizquerra, a Mexican-born mother who has lived in the U.S. for 2 decades, opted to seek sanctuary in a Denver area church instead of going to her immigration check-in Wednesday morning. She spoke by cell phone and through a translator to a group of supporters gathered outside of the office where her lawyer learned her request to stay her deportation had been denied.
So I want to say that I think that I made the right choice by not coming today. In my heart, I knew that today was different than in the past. In my heart, I knew that they were going to deny me my stay. And that is why I didn't come today. I am going to keep fighting. And I'm going to need my community here with me every step of the way in the next weeks and months.
President Trump's executive order on interior immigration enforcement expands the criteria for priority removal from fugitive criminals to anyone in violation of federal immigration law. Immigration rights advocates say the criteria is broad enough to lay the groundwork for the expulsion of millions of people, and that the deportation force Trump promised during the campaign is already taking shape. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
The U.S. Senate rolled back a rule this week that blocks some people with severe mental health issues from buying a gun. The vote fell slightly off party lines, passing by a margin of 57 to 43. The NRA, the ACLU, and some advocates for individuals with disabilities say the rule deprived disabled Social Security beneficiaries of their Second Amendment rights without any court order or adjudication and was indiscriminately broad. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said the rule unfairly stigmatizes people with disabilities.
The government is essentially saying that a person with a disability, such as an eating disorder, is more likely to be violent and should no longer be allowed to own a gun. There is no evidence to support that general idea, and consequently people being denied constitutional rights without due process. And if a specific individual is likely to be violent due to the nature of their mental illness, then the government should have to prove it.
But supporters of the regulation point out that the requirement was much more narrow, applying only to individuals mentally incapacitated to the extent that they require help managing their Social Security benefits. A hearing is required to determine the need for a representative payee, and anyone reported to the background check system had the right to appeal. Proponents of the limited gun control measure, like Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, point to polls that find more than 90% of gun owners support expanded background checks.
Whenever there is a discussion about guns in the United States Senate, senators get up and say, we shouldn't be debating guns. We ought to be debating mental health. That's what we're talking about here today. Mental health, and colleagues, we're talking about background checks.
Former President Barack Obama issued the regulation in the final weeks of his term, after Congress repeatedly failed to enact any substantial gun control legislation, despite a proliferation of mass shootings in the United States. Republicans targeted the rule under the obscure 1996 Congressional Review Act, or CRA, that allows Congress to reverse rules put in place in the past 60 days. Senator Murphy noted under provisions of the CRA, lawmakers may be prevented from imposing similar restrictions in the future. The House of Representatives easily approved the rollback earlier this month, and it now goes to President Trump. The intersection of mental health and access to guns includes self-harm. Suicide is at a 30-year high among all ages and is currently the second leading cause of death among 15 to 24-year-olds. Educators, families, and communities are grappling with the same questions. Why? What drove my loved one to take their life? How could this have been prevented? FSRN's Karen Argood reports.
Sherea Smith is warming up with friends in her choir class at Napa High School in California. The senior and straight-A student, who recently turned 18, is passionate about singing. But this bright and talented redhead is also a sexual abuse survivor and has experienced more than her share of loss.
You know, first I'm abused, and then I lose all my friends, and then my family, you know, betrays us, and I don't have, and it was like, oh my God.
Entering her teen years was a nightmare, says Smith, and at the age of 16, she attempted suicide for the second time.
Just the emptiness that I felt was so palpable, and I truly didn't believe that there was a point in trying. And so I just got it into my head that it wasn't going to get better.
Smith wrote a note, then took two bottles of pills.
So I just started to get really scared, because I felt my heart starting to slow down, and I was like, oh my God, you know, this is real. Like, this is actually happening. And I realized in that moment that maybe I didn't want to die. Maybe I just wanted to kill the part of me that wanted to die.
Sherea's mom, a teacher trained in teen mental health, was stunned when she found her.
There's embarrassment there too, and shame, because you're like, I mean, that's not at the forefront, but it's like, how can this be happening to me, like to my family, like, you know? And
Michelle Smith says she was forced to learn how to support her daughter rather than take on her distress.
We want to stick with compassion, because compassion doesn't pull us into their pain. We don't get entangled into their pain psychically, emotionally. Empathy, we lean into their pain and we start feeling their pain, and then we can't help them, because then we feel it and we're like stuck and we're just overwhelmed.
For more than two decades, Michelle has counseled other parents about how to support their teens through this challenging phase.
It's just being there, not judging it, not trying to fix it, and waiting for her to say, this is what I need. Sit down, listen to your kids.
Kiana, pay attention. So what did you do with these questions?
One thing that grounds Sherea is tutoring in the special needs class at her high school. Today she works with Kiana, a sophomore who has Down syndrome.
You're great.
Thank you. You're great, too.
High five.
Mary Butler is a licensed family therapist and for the past 14 years, she's also been chief probation officer for Napa County and has worked with suicidal teens.
The part of prevention that's really important is to help people understand that talking about suicide does not make people commit suicide.
Butler says in increasingly complex times, communities need to be proactive to combat the rise in teen suicides.
I mean, we're in a world now that is fast-paced, has a lot of pressure on children at a younger age. How they get their education is different. The amount of pressure to get a good education is all there, and it's all real. It's helping children cope through those parts of life. And if we give them those coping skills as children, they're going to be way better shape as adults anyway. Because if we give the children the coping skills and problem-solving skills so they have other choices, then they won't always feel like suicide's their option.
Denise Pope agrees. She's senior lecturer at Stanford Graduate School of Education and co-founder of Challenge Success, a nonprofit that seeks to offset these pressures. Pope says nationally there's a connection between more rigorous coursework and increased anxiety. And even though high school students are often stressed out about school, they tend to be less engaged in the learning process.
Even if you have straight A's, you might not be engaged. You might be playing the game. You might be doing a whole bunch of things. We have data on kids cheating. We have data on kids copying from each other. And basically a phrase that I coined called doing school instead of really having it be about the learning. And what we noticed is those were the same kids who were showing higher rates of depression, anxiety, eating disorders, suicide ideation at what were deemed to be really high-achieving schools and high-achieving kids.
These so-called high-achieving schools often pressure students to take AP courses, pressure that can begin even before their freshman year. And not all AP classes are created equal. Students often end up with enormous workloads, many of them in classes that they are not prepared to take. The pressure can result in stress, anxiety, ulcers, and sleep deprivation. Challenge Success is helping these schools monitor stress and health levels of the individual student as they consider which courses to take the following year. They are also working with school administrators on changes to AP policies, how to use time management worksheets, and how to create more project-based learning with less one-shot high-stakes tests. For Sharia Smith, finding balance has been key. Academics, coupled with service work and singing, seem to be shoring her up with just a few months to go until graduation. Karen Argood, FSRN, Napa.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to hear extended audio versions and read transcripts of stories heard on today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Roe Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Beat Dowsing via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.